From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Tyler Welsh.
And I'm Lydia Bailey.
This week on War News Radio, Moving Up, Moving Out, we discuss what stories in the news this week angered us the most.
Then, we learn more about France's involvement in the military conflict in Mali.
Next, we hear the stories of three veterans whose photography is on display in Philadelphia.
After, we examine responses to the lifted ban on women in combat.
Finally, we say farewell to one of War News Radio's greatest friends and treasured mentors.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Riots are spreading across Tunisia after the country's opposition leader, Chakri Belaïd, was assassinated outside his home on Wednesday. The Islamist-led government has denied any involvement in the killing, and no other parties have stepped forward to claim responsibility. The protests, centralized in Tunis outside the Interior Ministry's headquarters, are the largest public demonstration since the Tunisian Revolution 2 years ago. In an attempt to calm the riots, the Prime Minister, Hamadi Jebali, announced plans to replace all cabinet members with technocrats without party affiliations, and promised an election in the near future.
Intense fighting broke out in the Syrian capital of Damascus as rebels attacked government forces. At least 19 people were also killed by bombings in the Syrian town of Palmyra. This wave of violence comes after Syrian opposition indicated for the first time its willingness to enter dialogue with the government of President Bashar al-Assad. However, there is at least one precondition. Opposition leader Moaz al-Khatib said that he will consider the offer to have been rejected by al-Assad unless the government promptly releases all women detainees. The UN estimates that over 60,000 Syrians have died, and another 600,000 have been forced to flee the country throughout the 23-month conflict.
North Korea's National Defense Commission has declared its intentions to conduct the country's third nuclear test. China, North Korea's neighbor and possibly its closest ally, has denounced these plans. A state-run Chinese newspaper warned that Pyongyang will face severe consequences if it does coordinate a full-scale nuclear test. The details of the North Korean plan remain unclear, but it is likely that the timing of the test will be significant. The two previous tests both occurred on U.S. holidays, Columbus Day in 2006 and Memorial Day in 2009.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei is refusing to engage in talks with the United States about Iran's plans to extend its nuclear arsenal. The United States, the United Kingdom, China, Russia, France, and Germany had planned to hold talks with Iran about its nuclear program this month, after Iran declared it would add 3,000 faster centrifuges to its main uranium enrichment facility in Natanz. These centrifuges could potentially shorten the time required to construct a nuclear bomb. The U.S. also blacklisted Iran's state broadcaster, Internet Monitoring Agency, and Iran Electronics Industries, which is accused of manufacturing, monitoring, and eavesdropping devices. The new sanctions are only the latest in a series of efforts to abort Iran's nuclear program.
This is War News Radio. Sometimes it's hard to read the news without getting angry. Caroline Batten and Eliana Bisgard Church have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to news that makes us tear our hair out.
Just when we thought North Korea could not be more of a joke,
after the misunderstood Kim Jong-un meme anyway,
the government released a magical, shall we call it, propaganda video on board Unha 9. Just imagine, a strapping young North Korean dreams of U.S. destruction by missiles amidst sparkles, Dora the Explorer sound effects, and jubilant North Koreans waving their national flag. Wait, where did they find all these happy people?
Yeah, last time we checked, Kim Jong-un was the only person in the country who could find a decent meal.
Wait, though, have you Google imaged Kim Jong-un? He sports one serious double chin.
Well, the video's part Orwellian viciousness, part Disney ride, and part loony 70s brainwashing sequence. But the best part is not the shower of shooting stars or the psychedelic lights. It's that the footage of New York City burning down? Yeah, that was taken from Call of Duty.
Call of Duty.
Yup. And yeah, Activision, who makes COD, called them out on it.
Okay, so failed nuclear missiles and failed propaganda videos? Yeah, Kim Jong-un's a real threat, violating that copyright law.
What I don't get is, who do they think is seeing this stuff? North Koreans don't have internet. The South Koreans have the North Koreans firewalled. And all the Americans are sitting around saying, wait, is that Call of Duty?
Whoa. Are we back at our high school prom?
Leave room for the Holy Spirit, girls.
Oh no, that's just the background music for Pyongyang's video.
Wait, that's We Are the World. They used We Are the World for a video of New York going up in flames?
Classic.
Well, if that wasn't bad enough, Egypt is actually in flames.
Well, not quite. But protests have erupted in the country, with the worst violence since Mohamed Morsi was elected president.
Last week, over 50 people died in protests, and accounts of sexual assault against over 200 women at protests on the anniversary of Egypt's Arab Spring movement have left Egyptians and the international community outraged. Oh, yeah, and Egypt's top general is talking about the possibility of the collapse of the Egyptian state.
And yet, what is Egypt's Prime Minister Hisham Kandel worried about? Breasts.
Specifically, the, quote, unclean breasts of, quote, ignorant rural mothers, who apparently give their babies diarrhea by refusing to wash their tatas.
Yeah. Kandel, an agricultural engineer with a PhD from an American university, thinks that Egypt's diarrhea epidemics are caused by dirty boobs.
I mean, what? I could go on for days about how this is sexist, classist, and patriarchal, not to mention medically inaccurate. But mostly, it's just wildly inappropriate. 56 people are dead, and videos explicitly show violence against women at protests, and you're worried about boob germs? I stopped believing in cooties in second grade, Mr. Kandel.
But really, violence against women and police brutality are issues even we take seriously, as should the Prime Minister, who is instead wasting time blabbering about boobs. Shape up, PM.
Speaking of government incompetence, let's go a little closer to home. United States government, how are you screwing up today? Let me count the ways.
Despite real-time evidence of torture and killings by the Syrian government, the U.S. will still not consider the actions war crimes. Is this the 21st century? Did we ratify the Geneva Convention or the UN Convention Against Torture?
I feel like I'm back at Zero Dark Thirty, watching that awkward moment when CIA enhanced interrogators listen to a clip of Obama declaring the U.S. doesn't torture.
In other news, NBC this week got hold of a Justice Department memo from the Obama administration explaining U.S. policy on killing American senior operational leaders or those involved in associated forces in Al-Qaeda.
Whatever the heck that means.
Once identified, the U.S. can essentially kill said Americans if capture is deemed too burdensome to deploy U.S. forces. When is capture not burdensome? Am I missing something here? And if the threat is imminent. Sense some flexibility in these definitions?
Just a little. My favorite part of all these shenanigans is that the Obama administration had previously pretended there were no Justice Department memos on killing American citizens. Congressmen have requested to see these documents, claiming they need to know why the drone strikes are legal. Because apparently, they don't know.
Well, that's awkward.
Great summary. All right. For Filibusted, this is Caroline Batten.
And Eliana Biscard Church. It's been a pleasure, at least for us.
This is War News Radio. This week, War News Radio reporter Varun Prasad wrote a post on our blog about the conflict in Mali. Varun is with me now to talk about what he learned from researching his piece. So Varun, what's the latest in Mali?
At the moment, the parties in the area are at a detente. However, this is purely because the French entered Mali in early January 2013. They provided air support as well as ground support to the Malian government in the region and have helped recapture several important cities in northern Mali from Islamist extremists, including Gao, Timbuktu, and Kidal. After this, the French government proposes to hand over control of the region to an African military force sometime in the near future. In fact, this was confirmed by French President Hollande when he visited Timbuktu on February the 2nd of this year.
So who exactly is involved in this conflict and how?
Besides the French government, there is the government of Mali, a one separatist group currently allied with the government of Mali, and three Islamist groups that they're fighting against. So the government of Mali is an interim government that, and the president is Diane Kounda Traoré, and currently the government is fighting against these three Islamist groups, the Ansar al-Din, the Movement for Jihad and Unity in West Africa, or the Mojwa, and the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in northern Mali.
So what's the next step in this conflict?
Now the next step is for the French troops to withdraw from Mali in the short run, perhaps in the next 2 months. I believe that March is the date that President Hollande and the Defense Minister of France proposed. And after that, control of the region will be handed over to an African military force as early as March.
This is War News Radio. Earlier this month, War News Radio reporters Patrick Hahn and Amy DiPiero visited an exhibit of photography taken by veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts. The exhibit, From War to Home, Through the Veteran's Lens, is organized by Gala True, a folklorist and researcher at the Philadelphia Veterans Affairs Medical Center. The idea behind the project is to give veterans control over their own stories and their own healthcare at the VA.
In the spirit of From War to Home, today we bring you three stories from veterans whose images are featured in the exhibit. These stories have been edited for length, but we have left them without narration to let the words of veterans speak for themselves.
In the first clip, Tommy Cotter, an Iraq War veteran who served in the Marines from 2001 to 2005, tells his story of long waits and short staffs at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. In the second story, Tommy, who currently serves in the Army National Guard, recalls what it was like to be a soldier in Iraq and what it felt like to lose touch with a pen pal there.
The last story comes from Corporal Chantel Bateman of the Marines, who served in Iraq from 2003 to 2004. Bateman remembers the long hours and tough postures which marked her deployment and the feeling of being a menacing outsider.
But first, here's Tommy Cotter.
I was on a couple different things for like my back, like back pain, and then there was like kind of some of it was anti-inflammatory. It was like this mix, this cocktail they had me on that I was allergic to. It wasn't like one at a time.
Right.
It took them a while, like with their labs and screens, but they swelled up. Like I have little skinny wrists. I know you can't see that on the radio, but I'm a really skinny guy, and they swelled up like the size of baseball bats, and they were almost like round, and I couldn't bend them at all. And I told them, you know, that I was allergic to penicillin. They asked me why exactly I thought that. I said when I was a baby, they gave me penicillin and I had some kind of reaction and swelled up and got a rash. And I told the doctor this, and the doctor said that that happens with a lot of babies, that they're just sensitive when they're small. And now that you're an adult, that probably won't happen. But I go and take penicillin and I swelled all up. And then I wound up back in this emergency room over here. And I was sitting here, I said waiting for hours. And people that are relying on the VA for health care, like this is it, and they don't have health insurance, they basically have to wind up going to the emergency room. And then it's like every other emergency room in the world that they look at it like, you know, like an order of like, you know, what's more important and urgent and stuff like that. And you will be waiting there, and if it's just some small thing like a rash or maybe the flu or something like that, you can expect to be waiting a very long time, and that's a bit of frustration. Things like that, and when I want to get an appointment, that's a big problem here. I know it kind of sounds like trivial, but like Philadelphia is a huge area. This is just one hospital, and it has to deal with like so many veterans and stuff, and so many people coming here, and it just they're really kind of overloaded. I'm really thankful that all these like staff members here will like go through like, you know, all this stuff to take care of all of us, but I just don't feel like they have like the physical resources here, the space. There's just not enough doctors and whomever to really just take care of all of us. So it's nothing like personally when they get a hold, when they actually do get attending to you, I think it's just as great as any other doctor anywhere else. It's just they're kind of spread thin. I mean, they're doctors here, you know what I mean? Like, right. they follow medicine, and, like, this is, like, traditional medicine in that they just want to prescribe pills. Sometimes it is surgery, sometimes it is physical therapy, but I think that sometimes it would be nice if they looked into things, like, maybe... like I mentioned, I have this back pain issue, and I go to yoga, which, you know, you know, I'm not like some Zen master or something like that, but it really does calm me down, and I wish that sometimes that they take into account, like, there is some other things out there that they could do or suggest for us to be doing other than taking, like, you know, like, 7 different medications or whatever. The one I was speaking about, his name was Ravid. It was like R-A-V-I-D. It's almost like David, but he'd say it was Ravid. And the one I was pen pals with, he was in Saddam's bath party, which was like kind of like the bad guys in the beginning of the thing. Where he was getting involved was just like trying to get a job. A lot of like kids in the military too. I mean, whether it be patriotism or whatever, some people are there just because it's like a job and, you know, stuff like that. It was just interesting talking to this guy too, that he wasn't like, you know, thinking that we're the enemy or we're invading his country or anything like that. He was, I don't know, really just kind of trying to support his kids and stuff and have a house and an air conditioner and, I don't know, the simple things that mean a lot to them over there. But hanging out with him at this front gate, I'd be sitting there for, like, hours on end, and, like, we were kind of training these Iraqi police and Iraqi army at the same time to, like, get them to, like, kind of take over. I mean, the conversations were pretty simple because we didn't have, like, you know, a lot of words to use. They, like... soccer a lot, they call it football, and they talk about that left and right, and it was pretty interesting. And then I got his address after that when I got back, and I was writing back and forth with him. I'd say I got like all together like maybe 3 letters from him. I think I sent like 3 or maybe 4 to him, and then I never got a response back, and I just don't really know what to think. But like, it does worry me a bit, because a lot of times it doesn't get reported in the news, but we'd be going out with these guys a lot, and a lot of times those guys would be getting hurt, or people in their country would be getting, you know, all upset with them because they felt like they were taking our side, or sometimes those guys would, I don't know, fall victims to this violence and stuff over there. So, I mean, I really don't know what happened to that guy. Like I said, just like him, though, he had a wife and children and a house, and I don't know, played soccer and had his air conditioner, but... I don't know how to explain it. I mean, they are a little bit different than us, but I wouldn't say they're that far off with, like, what these people think about and want every day. I sometimes wonder just what is going on over there now without me, and, like, how these people are doing, like, Iraq in particular, because we've left them. And I wonder how they're doing. Like, you know, even that guy was just saying, I wonder what's going on there. I'd like to think that we kind of made a bit of a difference, because I did, like, spend a great deal of my life there, like, years that I'm not going to get back, and I'd like to think that, like, you know, out of all this stuff, that we try to help these people a little bit, you know, but it wasn't just all for, I don't know, whatever people think it is. I mean, I also get really confused, too, about what this whole thing really was about, but I don't know if you really want to go down that road or not.
Would you visit if you could?
Yeah, I would, definitely. I'd go right now. I'd go right now, to be honest with you, like, dressed like this, in, like, a Honda Civic. I'd really go.
The menacing posture that I talked about, me trying to look hardcore, I am locked and loaded, and I am not really that hardcore at all. I always had this mentality, like, if it's me or you, I want to go home, but I never wanted to shoot anybody. A long time ago, it feels like, I mean... after a while, it just becomes Groundhog Day. And they call it 12-1, 12-off schedule, 7 days a week. So 12 hours you work, 12 hours you're off. But that really averages, like, you know, 14 hours plus of work and hoping that there's no, you know, mortar fire in your sleep. The other image, I am in Costa Rica there. When I took that picture... I took it thinking, like, oh, man, my feet in the sand. It's, like, sort of like the antithesis of being, like, in Iraq and deployed. Your feet are always, you know, cooped up in some boots all the time. There's no such thing as, like, wiggling your toes in some sand. And sand where, you know, cool water washes up next to you, you know, and that you can dive in if you get hot. It was like a tough experience. Because, like, where we stayed was really, like, right in the hood. And, like, we didn't necessarily stay at a super fancy resort, but it was a nice place. And it's just, you know, just strange to drop in with your first world privilege on vacation in the middle of people's, like, real lives and homes. And you just wonder, like, what the implications are of being a visitor and a tourist. And enjoying the beauty of, like, places where people are struggling.
Did you feel like that sometimes when you were deployed?
Yeah. Yeah. And not necessarily because, like, I was, like, enjoying myself necessarily, but you just think of, like, you know, while you're standing menacing over a bunch of people who are making craptastic wages while, you know, I'm standing over them trying to look extra mean with a gun in my hand, like, you know. I think about that.
Those stories were produced by Amy DiPiero and Patrick Hahn. You can visit our website to see some of Tommy Cotter and Chantel Bateman's photos and to find out more about the From War to Home exhibit. On February 14th, the exhibit will debut at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing in collaboration with Michelle Obama's Joining Forces initiative.
This is War News Radio. On January 24th, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta lifted the ban on women serving in combat roles in the military. Reporter Amy DiPiero follows up with Chantel Bateman and others to find out what they think of the decision.
When I first asked Corporal Chantel Bateman what it was like to be a woman in the Marines, she told me that it's not that she feared men wouldn't trust her. It was just the truth.
On some level, as a woman, you feel like you have to, you know, put that extra on to be taken seriously and not to be within a number of levels.
2 days after our interview, at the end of January, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta lifted the ban on women serving in combat. But can that really change the culture Bateman was talking about? Supporters of the change say it will open career opportunities to women in the armed forces. But in a survey this summer, 17% of male Marines reported they would be likely to leave the Corps if women entered combat positions. When I called back Bateman, a former Northeast field organizer for Iraq Veterans Against the War, she said that was silly. Women are already in those roles anyway.
So really it's like being in a relationship and having kids with somebody, and after 10 years they're like, hey, you want to get married? Thanks for, you know, throwing a ring on it, but I've been your wife for the last 10 years.
It's not beta testing, it's on-the-ground testing in war.
Ariella Migdal is a senior staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU. In November, the ACLU filed a suit against the Justice Department, arguing it has no right to bar women from holding ground combat specialties. Migdal says women in female engagement teams, for example, carried the same gear and often faced the same danger as their male peers, but did not hold the same titles. Starting in 2009, these units of female Marines helped to visit and collect intelligence from Afghan women. They did not formally serve in combat missions, but commanders found ways to work around the ban.
Instead of assigning women to the units, they would attach them. Instead of integrating them directly into the units, they would put women in, quote, indirect support of the unit, but they'd still be out there doing foot patrols with the infantry.
Please don't make me sound like a chauvinist.
Thomas James Brennan is a retired sergeant in the Marine Corps and a veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
From the patrols that I've gone on with integrated female engagement teams, I wouldn't feel comfortable personally having them permanently attached to my squad. There were times where men had to carry some of their gear for them because they were getting tired and they were slowing down movement. And when you get patrols slowed down, you're just making yourself a more vulnerable target.
Brennan, now a reporter for the Robsonian in Lumberton, North Carolina, says female engagement teams were crucial to gathering intelligence in Afghanistan, but their jobs were not the same as those of soldiers in the infantry.
I'm not trying to discredit anything that the female engagement teams do. They've got some amazing female Marines, but they are not infantry.
Bateman, meanwhile, says lifting the combat ban might boost some career aspirations, but it won't change military culture or American culture.
It's interesting to be in a position to need to trust your life to someone who doesn't think you even belong here in the first place, who, you know, are constantly telling you that you can't cut it just because you've got a vagina. equality for women doesn't exist in the world. So, like, the expectation that a policy could change the culture of the military would just be, you know, some false hope.
While Secretary Panetta recommends integration begin as soon as possible, each service may appeal to the Defense Secretary for specific exceptions in the next several months. One thing that has changed? The Marine Corps announced at the end of 2012 that it would no longer use female engagement teams in Afghanistan. As of this year, Afghan National Security Forces have officially taken over the team's former duties. For War News Radio, I'm Amy DePiro.
This is War News Radio. War News Radio recently learned that journalist-in-residence Jim McMillan would be parting ways, moving to work on his burgeoning and successful reporting project GunCrisis.org full-time. A handful of reporters, Amy DePiro, Colin Smith, Caroline Batten, and Eliana Bisgard Church, had a few things to share about the man behind much of the magic at WNR.
If you're a student at a small liberal arts college, you might be able to boast that all of your professors know your name. You might say that most of them are happy to have long chats during their office hours, and one or two might even offer you some extra help before an exam. But I'm probably the only student I know who would even consider texting a professor on a Saturday night to ask a question. Luckily for me, Jim McMillan is probably the only professor who would respond. Jim might be War News Radio's journalist in residence, but nothing in the job description says you have to help a reporter come up with a question to ask an Army general on the fly. My efforts to approach that general were later thwarted by his Secret Service detail, but, false alarm or not, Jim is always on call. It's up to War News Radio to live up to the example Jim has set for us, to always be just a call, text, or tweet away from the stories we need to hear and the questions we need to answer. That's why we're going to miss Jim and wish him the best of luck. Thanks for everything, Jim.
Jim was always enthusiastic and passionate about our group, dedicating far more time to it than his job description required. Anytime I had an idea for a story or project, I knew I could count on him to listen and offer his well-informed guidance. He was the type of supervisor who immediately earned the love and admiration of those who worked with him, and his presence at Swarthmore will most definitely be missed.
Jim doesn't believe in upward limits. It's never, can you do the story? It's, how will you do the story? He holds us to high standards because he thinks we can meet them. And that kind of mindset, that's empowering. He taught me everything I know about broadcast. And to be honest, his devotion and excitement are a big part of why I now want to be a journalist.
If you ask Jim McMillan a question, you will get at least a 30-minute response. Maybe even 2 hours. Jim will answer your question, plus the 5 others you hadn't yet gotten around to, and will do so with mind-boggling expertise, rattling off stat after stat, detail after detail. Jim has been a journalist in residence and mentor for War News Radio for 3 years, my entire time with the organization. His thoughtfulness, extensive journalism knowledge and experience, Pulitzer Prize-winning skills, and deeply caring nature have further fostered a stimulating and curiosity-driven environment of student reporters. He has not only boosted our professionalism and quality of reporting, but has taught us to ask the really tough questions, digging deep for the story. Beyond this, he has been our number one supporter, encouraging our growth and development. From teaching me how to tweet, to the trick to a solid nut graph, to answering all of my questions, I have been honored to work with the esteemed Jim McMillan. We will all miss him greatly here at War News Radio, but wish him the best in his future endeavors.
Thank you, Jim, from all of us here at War News Radio.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Aaron Moser, Sabrina Singh, Colin Smith, Victoria Stitt, and Chloe Wittenberg. I'm Tyler Welsh.
And I'm Lydia Bailey. Until next time, thanks for listening.